Jeff Hill.
This evening, I'm going to talk about the tetrahedral test chamber, in particular, comparing this with our friend there, the IEC baffle, which all our standards say, if you want to measure loudspeakers, then you need one of those, an anechoic chamber. Well, I've been in the speaker business quite a long time, and I've always found that they're a pain in the proverbial. That one took us about half an hour to bring inside, another half an hour to set it up, and about another 20 minutes or something like that to get all the microphones and everything else working. So imagine if you're having to have one of these things in your anechoic chamber, and then somebody comes along and wants to do a different measurement, say a cabinet speaker. You're not going to be very happy. You probably won't do the measurement very well. And I believe that's one of the reasons why we're in such a mess with loudspeaker measurements. Anyway, without further ado, I'll move on. What I'm going to do is a brief lecture here. I'm going to show you some slides as we go through of measurements. And then afterwards, Dave Berriman from Clio is here, and he's got his laptop here, and we can duplicate the measurements that we've done here, that I'm going to be showing you, but actually in this environment here. So obviously the results aren't going to be the same, but it'll show what's going on, which is the which is to me the important point. So without further ado, a major problem, as I say, is that we can't rely upon measurements that are made from other companies wherever throughout the world. The tetrahedral test chamber gives us the capability of measuring accurately for the first time. It rigidly defines the measurement geometry, has interchangeable sub-baffles, so that you can get accurate and repeatable measurements. With many of them in use throughout the world, we should see a dramatic increase in our quality and our measurements. Our current measurements are based around our old friend, who I'm sure John there recognises. Yes, indeed. And that's the late John Bowers, taken in, well, John Bowers died in circa 1987. But unfortunately, our standards are based around the same things, haven't really changed. We don't make loudspeakers like the standard said in a laboratory with, you know, the white coat, etc. We did at one time, but nowadays, speakers are built all over the world and they're shipped in from all over the world. And it causes all sorts of chaos. And when things go wrong, the only people who really win are the lawyers. Our measurements are based around that. An IEC baffle in a nice big open space, or ideally an anechoic chamber. But even then, you're going to get the bounce from the speaker down onto the ground and back. So you're not going to get a perfect measurement even then. Yet alone, if you're in a high-volume production line, like where most of our loudspeakers are built, where you've got noise, production lines side-by-side, tests going off all the time, pack trucks going up and down. Anyone who's in the business is nodding along. Yep, we've been there. Anechoic chamber can work, absolutely. But it needs an awful lot of care. And the trouble is they start off at the size of a small house and go on up. So why are they so bad? Well, anechoic chambers vary slightly in their size and performance. You know, And yeah, literally, you know, they're really for the military. You know, you got lots of bucks. Yay, spend a couple of million on them. Why not? For measurement, for loudspeakers, is it really the best way? That's our friend there, which we set up in Dave's front garden in order to do the measurement. And you can see down to the left there, the test chamber there. You can see the relative size and the convenience. And that's a measurement of the IEC baffle measured outside at 1 meter. It's not a pretty sight, as we can see. We've got ground reflections and Christ knows what. We come in a bit closer, 316 mil, so minus 10 dB, plus 10 dB, cleaning up a bit, but not very good. Come in to 100 millimetres. It's getting a lot better now. We can actually see what's going on, but it's still pretty rough down at the bottom end. And, well, you don't want to be doing it on something like that if we've got the weather we've had over the past few months. Not practical at all, plus the size and everything else. So, we have an IEC baffle. Okay, this is a smaller one in the chamber. That should work a lot better, surely. You know, it's on the turntable, it's at a meter. Yeah, okay. Well, let's look at the measurements. Oops. Still not very good. We've got a nasty dip there and a series of ripples, mainly down to the diffraction off of the edge of the baffle. So even if we have got an IEC baffle, it's not perfect by any means. And you can plug the figures into the calculations and you can prove, Olsen proved many, many years ago, that it's the diffraction off the edge of the baffle that's causing all these problems. So IEC baffles aren't necessarily the right way to go. My idea is say, well, let's start with a different way. Let's start with a different shape. Start with the tetrahedron. Four identical equilateral triangles. But we change it and we slope it into a corner. Virtually everywhere has got a corner. Every room. Most of them have eight, don't they? So we usually find a corner from somewhere. We put a baffle on the front of it. And we put a microphone inside and we fire the speaker into it. We've now got a defined geometry. We've got a controlled environment. We know precisely what it is and it's going to stay the same. And this is an example of the DTC 900, which is the bigger brother of that. It's basically about three times that side, 900 millimetres, whereas that's 350 millimetres on a side. That will handle up to a 12-inch driver. This one will handle up to a 4-inch driver. But we can make them in whatever size you like. Bigger ones, people have said, we want to measure a 21-inch driver. Sure, we need the 1500 there. At that point, you can measure it to 1 metre. So you can get a standard measurement as well. Running a boundary element analysis using ABEC on the thing, we can see that at the low frequencies, this is with a perfect piston driving it, you've got a flat response from 20 hertz up to about 500 hertz. Then you've got some problems around about 1K before it starts breaking up. So basically, we can predict exactly what it's going to be doing at the low frequency end. We know exactly what it is. What we've got to do is we've just got to absorb, effectively, any reflections from, say, 1K upwards. And we know that we're going to have a stable environment that's going to work. Looking at the low frequency field distribution, at low frequencies, we can see it's pretty well constant pressure anywhere in the system. And both theory and practice would agree, you know, at low frequencies, you take a loudspeaker. It'll close box. It'll be fairly consistent. May not be exact, but it'll be pretty close. We can... Richard Small, back in 1972, 73, something like that, showed us how we could use measurements or inside, using a pressure transducer inside a cabinet to predict the low frequency response accurately. It was followed up a year later by Don Keel's paper with saying use similar target but using the external near field measurement of a driver in a box. And basically what I've done is taken both of those there but with a differently shaped enclosure which doesn't have standing waves in it, which is a key factor, combine those two together so we can make an accurate known correction curve to correct for the low frequency rise, which we're inevitably going to get, without having any nasty high frequency problems in there. And then we've got this example. And this is a measurement that we did on the TTC 350 of the same driver, which after this, Dave will demonstrate exactly the same using the Clio software. And we can see we've got a typical response, breakup peak at the high frequencies, a bit of a lump about 1K, which will depend on exactly where you set your curves, and then a low frequency rise below. All predicted by theory. We then put into it the correction curve that we want. As we can see, it's just a little bit of correction, 500 Hz to 1K, basically straight line going up to low frequencies and no correction at all at high frequencies. Completely clean. These are measurements here which were made, not of these ones here. This measurement here is off of another drive unit. This is a CS drive unit measured by the Klippel system. Versus data from CS themselves on that baffle. And you can see quite clearly the IEC baffle's response. And conversely, you can see where it's dropping off at a straight line rather than sloping up nice and smoothly at low frequencies, which it should be. There's a bit of a difference at the top end, but they're different drivers. And I haven't tried to equalise it or play with it in any way. And then that's this drive unit there, but in the TTC 350 after we've done the necessary correction for the low frequencies. And we can see that it's a nice, smooth, clean response, perfectly good. And then we compare that to the data for this drive unit off of CS's website. You can go onto CS's website anytime, and that's the data that you will see. It's literally just taken it. And if I flip back, you can see how close they are. Yeah? There's no doubt they're the same type of driver. I'm talking to the IEC. They're talking about updating driver standards. And the AES back at the New York 135th seminar convention launched a X223 loudspeaker driver correlation chamber. I've submitted some data to that. Subsequently to that, I've talked to ICAT in Shenzhen, and the Chinese standards people are also interested in coming on board and getting to the point where we can have a standardised approach to this problem. I believe it's a serious problem, and virtually everyone that I talk to is saying, yeah, this is a serious problem. It's costing us serious money, but we don't know how to fix it. There isn't a standard. There isn't a way around it. Alma, I'm talking to them. Do they want him involved or not? I don't know. Waiting. And I'll be taking this to the AES in Berlin shortly. That's the 350. That's the 900. Acknowledgements. Phil Knight for a lot of early discussions on things. Dave Berriman, Mario Biggie of Audiomatica Clio. To Alan and the production team. And AES, ICET, etc., etc. There's the references. Anyone who's interested in this, give us a yell. We've got a website, there's information there, and you're more than welcome to have a copy of this presentation. Any questions anyone's got, please ask. And shortly, you know, we can, I'd like you people, if they can, come down. Dave can demonstrate the measurements that I've done here, and you can see yourselves exactly what we've got and how things work.
Can I just ask a question?
Absolutely.
I might have missed it or been asleep or something, but how did you actually create that correction curve?
Basically, you divide the internal response by the external response, and then you chop off the high frequencies. Because the
theoretical or measured?
So that was a measured response in this case here. But you can see from the curve itself, you can actually predict it from the theory as well. But I haven't actually shown that here. Yeah. And the theory, if you run a full FEA model, which I've done, you can actually predict what that curve is going to be anyway because of the design.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it have diffraction ripples in it that are different than that? The baffle?
A baffle response may do, yes. But what?
Oh, so this correction is
for the chamber. It's not designed to try to correct for a baffle because.
It's designed to give a baffle result.
No. You could set it up to do that if you want to.
So you just need to do it once for each size of enclosure.
Exactly. You know where the microphone is, you know where the drive unit is relative to that. Once it's set, it's stable. That's it.
What is that for octave? Is it six? I can't really see it.
Yes, on the side there, that's 10 dB per octave. That's minus 30, minus 10.
So it's easy to correct, I'm seeing.
Oh, yeah, as you can see, it's an absolutely straight line.
Those ripples at the low end look to me like a measurement artifact.
Yes.
They'll be, because as the signal drops off, the signal to noise ratio gets a bit worse and you get a few ripples in the left response. We haven't really tried to deal with that because I don't think they're particularly interested in what's happening.
Yeah. No, the all of this data is warts and all. We're not trying to cover anything up. You know, I much prefer to show you raw results that you can say, maybe that's not quite right, rather than try and fiddle it. No, it's what it is.
Where does the microphone go?
The microphone is effectively in the corner of the chamber, pointing out directly coaxial to the centre, so you can see it on there.
But that red handle is where the microphone is.
No. It's inside, in the middle. There's a tiny little dot in the middle.
Yeah, got it. Okay, beg your pardon.
So obviously on a bigger chamber, and these are only designed for up to 4-inch drivers, we're fairly close in on the thing. The larger chambers, you can measure further away. But most of our markets nowadays want small drivers. And people say, we don't want a big chamber. We want a small chamber. Sure. Okay. Fine. Have a small chamber. it makes it a lot easier to carry around anyway, so no problems compared to this monstrosity.
What would the result look like if there were no damping material at all in there? It might be usable, actually.
It is usable. It is usable.
The damping material might actually cause variations from one unit to the next. It's hard to make that exactly right.
It's pretty good. It's not that... But you're better off actually having that in there, because inevitably you get some high-frequency reflections going in there, and you're better off actually wiping them out so that you don't contaminate the results.
You have to avoid any high slopes in the response.
Yeah, exactly.
Because if it's a resonance and it shifts slightly in frequency, suddenly failed the unit because it shifted by 6 dB or something.
Well, precisely. Hang on, I've got the wrong one. F5. And if I... And that's the advantage of doing it this way. Most test boxes, if you look at a curve like that, very often you do not get a curve in here like that, as John knows. Very often you get big peaks and dips. And then if you're working as often you are, trying to find, say, a faulty surround or something that's glued not properly, you often get a dip at around about 800 hertz, 900 hertz, 1 kilohertz. And then you're fighting, well, is the problem the test box? Is the problem we've got a faulty surround? Or is it a bit of both? Because actually the test box itself has got a response and it's going down. And maybe you've got that's happening at just the point where the drive unit is going up as well. And then there's a slight shift in frequency, and you can be battling it for...
Inevitably, you're going to get production variations.
Yeah.
And if that peak at the top shifts by 300 hertz, which it will do, the measurement at that point will have shifted 10 dB or something.
Precisely. But if you were in the position and you had to fault find a drive unit and you had a data curve like that, you'd be able to do it very easily, wouldn't you? But how many times do you find that? You don't. That's the problem. And this is what I'm trying to...
I just have a comment to make. From time to time, we bought in units from China that were not made by us.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly tweeters and things. And they will insist on sending responses of prototypes done in the JAS.
Yes.
It's impossible to tell what's happening there. And I constantly sending back the response of the same unit with a perfect flat response, just measured, stick it on the end of a pole or something in the Tannico chamber, saying, this is what your unit's really doing. You're sending me this and asking me to make a judgment, you know. So it'd be nice to be able to see responses which actually relate to what the unit's doing.
Well, that's my aim, and I think it's essential, you know, that this industry as a whole gets to that point. And it's not just the hi-fi loudspeaker people who've got this problem. It's the mobile telecoms, it's the PA. Everyone who does anything to do with loudspeaker transducers sooner or later comes up against exactly the same problem. And one of the reasons, I believe, is because the JIS test box and our friend, the IEC baffle, is so deeply embedded in our standards. And it needs to... The standards need updating.
JIS, yes.
Yes.
I'm going to ask a really stupid question.
No such thing as a stupid question.
As far as I can see, however you offset the microphone, however you offset the speaker in that box, you're going to get a series of a comb of reflections at around the 1-2K region, which is one's relying on the damping to kill them. and I know that the tetrahedron is going to thoroughly confuse standing waves, but nevertheless, there are going to be reflections because of the proximity of walls in that box.
Yes.
To what extent is that really affecting those measurements up in those high-frequency areas? And to what extent are you actually allowing for that in your correction curve?
It's being allowed for completely, because if you look at the correction curve, if I find it there, we can see where we've got the main reflection in there. That's the key portion that we need to do in order to be able to correct. That's effectively the only correction that we need in order to get a standardized response.
But that box is going to have reflections peaking at the 1 to 2K area. Presumably that's the correction curve for larger boxes, isn't it?
No, that is the correction curve for this chamber. That is the correction curve for this chamber.
And presumably those reflections are killed specifically by that damping, which goes back to the previous question about...
Yeah, but the thing is, there's two factors. That anechoic chambers, if we take anechoic chambers as being, the gold standard, they've got various problems, in my view. The most serious of which is that you cannot absorb all waveforms. You certainly, on an anechoic chamber, can't absorb a wavefront of, say, 10 hertz, because you need wedges that will be 34 metres long or something, 17 or 34 metres long, depending on how you calculate it. I don't know of any chamber, including the military ones, that big. So at some time, there's going to be a cut-off point where you're not going to be able to absorb effectively. At the same time, we do know that we can absorb very effectively wavefronts from, say, 500 hertz upwards. We can do that very reliably. So these chambers are designed to say, right, I minimise the problems that we've got. At low frequencies, I don't even bother trying to correct them or absorb them, because I know I can't. It's impossible, so don't bother. But make sure that there's sufficient absorption in there to mop up effectively anything at the higher frequencies from, say, 500 hertz upwards. Because the absorption materials that we've got nowadays can take those out completely. So that we know that from those frequencies upwards, we are in a stable environment. We have got controllable absorption there, and that's why that curve there is, apart from that slight lump at 500-600 hertz, it's a straight line. I'm not, yes, there's some absorption in there at the low frequencies, but at those, once you get down to 20 hertz or 50 hertz, the wavelength is so long, does it see that little bit of absorption? No.
It's interesting because that shape that you have there, that's exactly the same shape as an optical corner reflector.
Oh, is it?
If you start a plane wave in the plane of your baffle there, then the ray going straight out will hit all three panels and come back, and every ray leaving that thing will have exactly the same path length. So that actually generates a standing wave with an absolutely fixed position. And you need the damping to get rid of that one. Because it's a very powerful standing wave. And if you had used a true tetrahedron, you wouldn't have had that. So I'm just wondering, this choice is perhaps made for other reasons, but a tetrahedron might actually be better from a theoretical point of view. But I agree that frequency is relatively high, and your damping probably takes it out. It's an interesting geometric property, actually, of a corner. Three mirrors in the corner. If you look in there, you'll always see your own eye. It's a perfect reflector.
Yeah.
In any direction.
It's true.
Yeah, and that's what it's based on. So having that there, so you can do that. You know what it is. Yes, we've got a boost, and we've especially got a boost at the low frequency end. But it doesn't matter.
No, it's not a plane wave, but that doesn't matter because when you have a box, it's not a plane wave.
You know, you get more of a boost at the low frequencies, as you say, John. But that doesn't matter. We can EQ that out, especially with modern test equipment. You know, from Melissa onwards, you know, we've been able to accurately EQ. The problem that we've got with most of our loudspeaker measurement systems is not the measurement systems. They're great. But it's the setup of the measurements, having the microphone set up badly, having the boom arm in the wrong place, reflections off of the floor, just the sheer number of variables that you get. Yeah, it's great if you've got a perfect chamber and you can afford it, etc., etc. But even then, there's an awful lot of things that can go wrong. And does that happen, and can that happen at the end of your production line? No, the truth is it can't. Whereas this, the idea is that you can use it at the design stage, at your production stage, at your QC stage, at your customer stage, right the way through, identical systems. Doesn't matter where the... Yes, sir.
I may have missed this. Where does the microphone go?
The microphone goes in the middle, in the corner.
Inside the enclosure.
Inside the enclosure. Yeah. Yeah. Right in. It's effectively in the middle, in the corner, pointing.
Are you thinking that this basically is designed to measure response at low frequencies? No,
right the way through the whole range.
What happens in the situation? I mean, you can't have it both ways. If you fill the material up with damping material, which absorbs the high frequencies, and then you put the microphone inside, there aren't any high frequencies.
No, there's nothing no. between the microphone and the speaker.
Nothing between the cone and the microphone.
Okay. So. The microphone's in the middle, not the corner.
Yes. I don't know if you can. Can you see that there? That's the microphone there.
Level with the surface of the absorption.
Yeah, it's above the level. If you come down, you can actually see this one and see the one there. Please come down and you can actually see it. And then you can see the actual results. And no, it's clear.
It would be fair, though, to compare the IEC baffle measurements at the same distance from the...
Oh, yes, and I did.
And then you get quite a clean response from an IEC baffle.
Absolutely, and that's what I showed her. That's what I showed.
Yeah.
Hang on, where is it? There.
Yeah, yeah,
and that is a nice, clean response. There's a few little ripples in there, true, but it's about right. But if you compare that to the response that you get here, it's pretty damn close.
I agree.
I think the main thing is, in production, you're comparing one with a reference.
Exactly.
Every time you're just comparing with a reference, you think, really, it doesn't matter how it was
made. Yeah.
But it's a point I made earlier. You have to have a reasonably smooth response, otherwise you start throwing out good drivers.
Yep, false negatives. False negatives, whereas this will avoid the false negatives problem. You've got a good enough response there that you could, if you had to, you could rely on it from your, you know, R&D stage. And when you put that into the production stage, it's way better. And so you don't get the false negatives. You can actually see, oh, right, we have got a drive in it, but it's got the wrong voice coil in it. You can see even, you know, the response smoothly going up. The resonance is in the wrong place. Normally you can't see that sort of data, as you well know. So I think it's got a lot of advantages going for it. But
sorry, is that the tetrahedral response?
Yes, that's the tetrahedral response.
Is it possible to flip quickly back to the original manufacturer, please?
That's Sears's response. This is a measurement measured in their test box, the 2.5 litre test box, and the response there has been deliberately set up so as to duplicate a test chamber rather than a baffle response. All that means is just changing where you splice the correction curve at, so you can actually directly see exactly what's going on. There and there. And in there, and in the CS response, you've got response, I think it's at 30 and 60 degrees and on axis. And of course, the impedance, which I haven't shown.
Is it going to be used in production? So could you quickly slot in a unit so that you could actually check?
Yes. Well, that's what the idea of it is exactly, and that's what we'd like to do. When there's, you know, gone through this bit here, we'll hand over to Dave on his computer there, and you can actually do some measurements, and we can see measurements on the IEC baffle and on the tetrahedral chamber, and you can see it live measurements yourselves. You know, we can put it on the screen as well if you like, if it works. but last time we tried that, it fell over badly, I'm afraid. Okay. Any more questions?
How would you fix your speaker? And if you're on the production line,
right?
Keep putting units in order.
Well, that's quite simple. What you've got is you've got a series of test baffles, and you make up a test baffle.
Well, that's what. All right.
For every drive unit, which if you're in loudspeaker production, you have to have a test baffle anyway. That's standard, and so you just take that one there, and you just change it over for another one. I think we've probably got some different ones here. Is it the other one? Right, and here's one for a tweeter. So you just literally take that there. It's literally seconds. It's literally seconds. So we take that there.
Critical element is the consistency. This should always be consistent.
So you put that on there. You put that on there.
Consistent in China, consistent wherever
you put that on there, and you're ready to go. You know, and if instead we want to change over, and instead of measuring the base unit, we want to measure a tweeter, we put the tweeter baffle in, put the tweeter in there, I measure the tweeter. The bigger versions are obviously accept bigger drivers. Yeah. That's it.
Is there no damping on that triangular plate?
No.
Okay, it's stuck.
I might be able to yank it. Yeah, so that's just plain on the back.
Okay, I see.
So there's no absorption there to cause...
What size driver can you measure up to on some of your bigger models of tetrahedron?
Can go up to, theoretically, the 1500 will measure up to a 24-inch driver.
Why are drivers still measured in inches?
ask a marketing man.
I'm told by the only lady in the room that it's because inches is the only measurement that men understand.
Tires are going inches too, like that. You can divide by two as well.
So basically, you know, they're available in a range of different sizes to handle the different jobs. I think.
Also, the larger chamber, this is very handy for cutting around the small chamber.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you go to a bigger chamber, not only does it measure larger buffers, but the whole thing will be scaled down as well, isn't it? So all your modes and everything shifting down in frequency, more phone you need to absorb. So
yeah.
That you choose to say definitely.
Yeah. It's
more accurate, would you say, if it's a bigger...
This is pretty accurate anyway. So, but the important thing is not the absolute accuracy in my view. You know, I'd like to say yes, this would make anechoic chambers completely redundant. No, it's not going to happen, and there's a good reason why it shouldn't happen. What I do believe this will do or should do is get stable, consistent measurements from one place to another place to another place to another place. And that in itself, I think, is something that's worth having.
The white paper that you produced earlier, Jeff, indicated quite well the variation between the IC baffle and the tetrahedrons.
Yeah.
And the accuracy comparison between them. Now, that paper is published on the web. Anybody can have a look at that and actually see that comparison and see how the two compare quite clearly.
Yeah.
Now, that was with Doppler equipment. The same exercise has just been done with Clio equipment. I don't think the actual measurement equipment is relevant, more the method.
The measuring equipment is irrelevant.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is exactly one of the reasons why I've tried to tackle this problem, because we've got measurement instruments, whether they from Clio, Audio Precision, Melissa, Clipbook, etc., and they're capable of fantastic accuracy. You know, 0.1 dB, no problem. But we can't, as an industry, measure to plus or minus 3 dB of frequency response consistently. To me, it's a joke, and it's not a funny joke. And it's time that, you know, as an industry, we moved on and did better, I believe.
Is there any driver pathology that would not be captured very well by having a microphone so close? You might wish a 1 meter measurement or 50 centimeters.
If you want a 1 meter measurement or a 50 centimeter one, you just use the bigger models.
Yeah.
And then you've got, you know, the 900, which is, you know, fractionally off of 1 meter in size, will measure at 316 millimetres, and the 1500, 1.5 metres, will measure at a full metre. So if there are specific instances, which there may be, then, and you need to have that, then you need to go to that bigger chamber. But my view is that the most important thing is not necessarily the absolute accuracy there, but the relative accuracy and the stability of the measurement. Especially if you're talking about small 1-inch, 2-inch, 3-inch, 4-inch drivers, that sort of thing. What you want to do is you need to make sure that they are the same, one to the other, you know, over the hundreds or thousands of drivers that are being made.
I was just wondering whether there might be a near-field measurement which would show driver differences, but at 1 meter they'd be gone. Just some cone breakup.
Maybe. I haven't got the data, John. Okay. All right. If there aren't any more, I think what we should do is hand over to Dave, if I may. Dave.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.